Hey everybody, it's Mike. Welcome to a special limited series presented by the Canon Cantina. This is the first installment of Comments on Commentary, a limited series where I watch all of the Star Wars films with the director commentaries on, and sometimes I'll try and watch the documentaries associated with them. I take a lot of notes, and I'm just going to talk about what I learned either seeing these documentary tracks for the first time or revisiting some of them for the first time in more than 10 years. As you all know, Jesse is out on paternity leave, so I have a temporary electronic co-host filling in for him. I found an old astromech out in my garage, and he's done a great job so far. B5TR, how's it going today? That's right, yeah, I'll call you Buster. So thank you for joining me on this just journey back through the commentary on episode one. So when I set out to do this series, I wasn't exactly sure how I would, organize everything when I sat down to actually record my reactions and what I had learned from the commentaries. Because I knew that I would learn things about, you know, how the movie was made, and we'd be getting commentary from George and other people back in the prequel era. We're getting a lot of Rick McCollum, the prequel era producer. But I wasn't really sure how I was going to organize this until after completing my watch through of The Phantom Menace. So I'm going to break down what I learned and just the thoughts I have into three categories. I'm going to start with the filmmaking or technical aspects that were either new things that I learned or cool things that I remembered. A lot of Ben Burtt featured in those, the sound design extraordinaire. The middle section I'm going to devote to storytelling. This could be specific storytelling within this movie or within the Star Wars universe, or I think just storytelling or writing tips that would apply to anything. George Lucas is a fantastic storyteller, one of the best of several generations. Not always the greatest director, but there is a lot of great insight from him in this section. And the third section is just other fun or important random information that I picked up that I either had forgotten or learned for the first time. What I'm not going to do is sit here and rehash the plot and dialogue and music and effects and whatever of The Phantom Menace or any of the films in this series. I know that you've all seen them before, and you may have even seen these commentaries I'm talking about before, but in case you haven't, I'm just going to kind of go through, you know, those three sections that I just mentioned. And I guess each section will happen chronologically through the film, but I'm not going to worry about making sure I tell the complete story of The Phantom Menace because you're Star Wars fans, you've seen it already. So starting into the technical or filmmaking section, most of the information learned in the section came from Ben Burtt, sound designer on the original trilogy, and the prequels, went on to be the voice of Wally. Rick McCollum, the producer of the prequel trilogy. I'm not actually sure what Rick is up to these days. That should be an interesting Google. And Dennis Muren, he is one of the prop or miniature effect designers that was brought back, I believe, from the original trilogy. I knew all three of these names from a CD-ROM that came with LucasArts video games, I think, back in the 90s. They showed a little bit about how the CD-ROM was mainly dedicated to this is how we're making the special edition of the original trilogy, but we'd get a few tidbits of this is how we are using technology to film episode one. I'm pretty sure I'm not combining Lucasfilm CD-ROMs here. So a lot of the new technology that was used in filming The Phantom Menace, some of us had gotten a sneak peek, I guess, of early animatics or whatever on that Behind the Magic CD-ROM from Lucasfilm and LucasArts Games. So the first thing we learned from Ben Burtt is that the vast majority of sound effects in The Phantom Menace are real acoustic recorded sounds. Nothing, practically nothing, synthesized or digitized. Not surprising when you consider just his background as a filmmaker. What he followed that up with, though, was something interesting. He said that 85% of the dialogue in The Phantom Menace is ADR, which stands for Automated Dialogue Replacement or Advanced Dialogue Replacement. That is what happens when actors come back in and just re-record their lines that they had said on set initially so that the director and sound designers and engineers can make sure they get the appropriate clean recording and correct any cadence issues or intonation, things like that. So I know that ADR is a big part of making movies. I would not have guessed that 85% of The Phantom Menace is re-recorded dialogue. I thought that was pretty interesting. The first time we heard from Rick McCollum, it's when the crew first arrives, or we see our first shots of the Royal Palace on Naboo. And he called the just that panning shot a turning point in their filmmaking technology at ILM. Called it an animated matte painting that they were able to, you know, pan the cameras around. And I specifically remember back on that Behind the Magic CD-ROM, their walkthrough for how they made the digital waterfalls that are happening off the cliffs by the castle. I don't remember all the details, but I remember they said they started with recording salt particles, like individual grains of salt, and creating this waterfall, except instead with water, it was with individual grains of salt and recording how those acted and then making it more advanced and more fluid-like from there. The first time we heard from Dennis Murren, he's talking about one of Jesse's favorite aspects of the prequel trilogy, the, quote, big-atures, not miniatures, but giant practical props that are still miniature versions. This was something I was not aware of. The Trade Federation lander that they send several of down to the planet that land in the forest. I assumed that was just a digital model, but it's actually a 5-foot-long physical model, which is pretty impressive. I quickly noticed a theme in this commentary track. Rick McCollum often was brought in right after a transition to a new scene or new location, or anytime we had a big sweeping introduction to a new location. When the Jedi and Jar Jar first get down to Oto Gunga, we see that it's an entirely new ecosystem and type of city from anything we'd seen in Star Wars to this point. He spent a lot of time, a few minutes, talking about the complexity of the shot, how they were trying to get all the textures right, and that just the panning in shot while they're swimming through the water and then walking through the airlock portal bubble thingy took several weeks because they were still perfecting these technologies at the time. So once inside the bubble of Oto Gunga, again, another set that I thought was entirely blue screen, but Dennis Murren let us know that this was a miniature set that was then inserted around what they had filmed of the actors. So not a completely digital background. They just merged a miniaturized 4 to 5 foot across version of the city background with what they recorded with the actors, which is pretty cool. The first time that George Lucas chimed in with something that I'm qualifying under our technical or filmmaking aspect was a style of editing, which I thought was very interesting. He talked about the ways he will use montage editing in action sequences to show a lot happening, but still advance the story relatively quickly and not let the audience in on everything, but they're actually okay with not having the beginning, middle, and end of each sequence. So paraphrasing what George said, he called this montage editing, showing only the middles in set pieces, jumps in the moving story. It's something he says started in episode 4, which next time I watch episode 4, I'm actually going to look for. But basically cutting the middles of a bunch of set pieces together so you don't have the full information of the beginning and end of each of those, but it still fits in the cohesive story and lets you speed up the pace and get to the next important narrative point. I thought that was very interesting. It's The Phantom Menace. We can't not talk about the Roger Rogers, the B1 battle droids, the stormtroopers of the prequel trilogy. I have accepted the battle droids for what they are. Cheap, relatively ineffective droids that were developed to just overwhelm enemies with numbers. We'll learn a lot about the battle droids just kind of throughout this, but I did not know they were using early motion capture technology in creating the battle droids, and the way that they moved was actually based off of early mocap that Ben Burt, the sound designer, did, and apparently Ben has a unique walk, and that became accentuated with the kind of battle droid shape of their hips and legs. So the funky battle droid walk can be attributed back to Ben Burt. That's right, Buster. It would not be a Star Wars movie if we did not go to a sand planet. So when we finally get to Tatooine, we learn from Rick McCollum that the first shot that they filmed was the Jedi and Padme walking away from the Queen's starship. And you can notice that Natalie Portman has a limp in that scene, and it actually carries through to the next few that they filmed chronologically. She'd apparently injured herself the night before, and when you look for it, it's actually pretty noticeable. And it wouldn't be filming in Tunisia without problems. They were all set to start filming, and then 100-mile-an-hour wind sandstorms destroyed a lot of the sets they had, set timing back. Very, very Tunisia-ish. So I guess maybe it's a good thing that for Episode 9, JJ went to Jordan for the sand planet instead of Tunisia. Sticking with Rick McCollum, we get the scene of Darth Maul and Darth Sidious together on the balcony in Coruscant. And maybe this should go in just kind of the random knowledge section, but Rick McCollum tells us this was the very first shot filmed in the movie, which to me seems more like something that would have been added as a reshoot or a pickup that was done later. But the actual very first footage recorded was of Darth Maul and Darth Sidious. Yeah, okay, we'll go back to talking about Ben Burtt, the person responsible for how you communicate, I guess. There's a part when they cut back to Mos Espa, as they're starting to have their conversations with Watto. Ben Burtt talks about something that I had understood conceptually but never put words to. The off-screen movie, which to him is the movie that runs adjacent to what we actually see, you know, on screen. It's the off-screen movie. The off-screen movie is what is making the sounds that you hear but you don't see. And that's a fascinating level of detail that's in all movies. I know this, but it's something I'd never thought about from that perspective before, which was very, very cool. When we get to the night scene on Mos Espa, where Qui-Gon is taking the blood sample of little Annie, I know that Jake Lloyd was 8 or 9 years old. I'm just a little bit older than him, so I remember being jealous of him at the time that he got to make The Phantom Menace. This scene was a reshoot. It was replacing a scene they had done previously. I think that George said they'd originally drawn the blood in the garage or something, but they wanted to do it at night, so they could talk about visiting the stars. But this reshoot happened 13 months after they'd finished filming, and they had to be careful with how they positioned Jake Lloyd because he had grown 4 inches in those 13 months. So they had to try to make sure that you couldn't see all of him in the frame at once, or it might be noticeable that, oh, hey, he looks a lot taller in this scene than the others, which is pretty funny. And the reality of working with child actors, I guess. Yeah, we're to my favorite scene of the movie also. Well, arguably this and the lightsaber fight, but I love the pod racing scene. And Ben Burtt called this the largest task he had was creating the individualized pod racer engine sounds, because none of the pod racers all sound alike. When he was starting to catalog his sounds and figure out, okay, how am I going to start creating these space NASCAR vehicle sounds, George Lucas told him to start with just Earth cars. So Ben Burtt recorded high-speed cars, Ferraris, Indy cars, drag racers, even motorcycles, and ended up combining those with things like the sounds of electric toothbrushes and motorboats to create the unique pod racer sounds for each driver. Once the heroes return to Naboo, when they're getting ready to, or actually they're getting ready to leave Coruscant and go to Naboo, George Lucas interjected with talking about how he framed the shot. So I'm by no means like a filmmaker or major or anything, but I do know a little bit. I know about the rule of thirds, dividing the screen into thirds and where you want to have your subject centered. But George talked about how in this scene, he intentionally did not do that. He tried to use a more documentary style filming that on close-ups, it let people or subjects float around the screen. The screen was not centered on any one person or conversation. It's especially noticeable when they are walking back to the Queen's ship. If you watch, if you try to track where Jar Jar is, I'm not sure why George felt like throwing that in there, but it's a very, you know, just kind of cool filmmaking tip, I guess. B5, what do you think about the Gungans? Yeah, I mean, they catch a bad rap, but at the time, I was a fan. When I was a kid, I was a fan of Jar Jar and Boss Nass. Got a little cynical in college. I accept them for what they are now. But one of the visual effects leads, his last name's Coleman, and I actually forgot to write down his first name, but he talks about the most challenging scene for the visual effects team that involved Jar Jar Binks. was the scene after Boss Nass has decided to help the queen and her people. It's when Jar Jar and Boss Nass are walking arm in arm. He called this the most difficult CG shot that they had, and it took several animators 8 weeks to animate the two Gungans walking together, just because of the different sizes of the characters and the differences in clothing and lighting and skin and all that stuff. So 8 weeks for what amounted to, I think, like 7 seconds that wasn't even the focal point of that scene. Very interesting. I wonder what that would take with, you know, today's ILM technology. Yeah, just continuing with that comparison of what would happen today. I know that a lot of people with the rise of Skywalker and to another extent Rogue One were freaking out that there were reshoots happening relatively close to the release date. And particularly with Rise of Skywalker, reshoots or edits or whatever. I don't know how much of those ended up being true, but people felt it was coming down to the wire. And this next insight from Ben Burtt let us know that that's just kind of a Lucasfilm tradition. They were making edits and additions to the sound effects and some of the visual effects up to the week before they had to distribute the movie to theaters. And this was back when we were distributing it on film. So that's just, I guess it's in the Lucasfilm DNA. One last bit of the technical or filmmaking side of things here. When we get to our celebration, Rick McCollum chimed back in. The Gungan Marching Band, as I've always lovingly called it as a former band nerd, that sequence took 4 weeks to animate, and it was the last shot they completed before releasing the film, finishing the ending right before shipping, I guess, going actually in chronological order. Yeah, so that's the end of what I kind of considered to be the technical or filmmaking lessons learned or just interesting tidbits that I picked up from the commentary. We're going to go back to the beginning now and talk about the storytelling lessons learned. And most of this, if not all, is from George Lucas. But very interesting, and I'll see what kind of context I can give for each of these. So right during the opening crawl, George Lucas chimes in with dropping some storytelling truth bombs on people. He says that structurally, all of these films start the same way. And I'm paraphrasing most of these quotes here because I was just actually writing notes down instead of typing, so I didn't catch everything word for word. But he likened all of these films to primarily silent films with dialogue and sound effects and just effects as part of a musical composition to tell a story. And I know people have created fan edits or cuts of entire movies with the dialogue removed. I've seen petitions for Disney to put those versions on Disney Plus, which I think would be a fantastic new way to watch these if we could somehow watch it with just the music and sound effects, but no dialogue, or maybe even just music. Maybe that's the next limited series I do, watching Star Wars as a silent film. I mentioned earlier that the B1s were kind of goofy, and George came out, and I don't know if this was something he decided when it was time to do the commentary or if he was planning this far ahead, but he wanted to establish the B1s as slightly goofy droids very early in the story so that throughout the course of the prequels, we could see the technology and just like warfare, like ability of the opposition improve. Yeah, the change we get from like the B1s roger-rogering around asking where are you taking them and not understanding the question to the super battle droids of Attack of the Clones and then maybe I guess the Magna Guards and Grievous of Episode 3. It definitely fits what we've seen on screen, so maybe George did have a plan the entire time. If you have an interest in screenwriting, maybe write this one down. I think this might be one of the more important things that George said. He said that you can't have a scene that just does one thing, like introduce a character. And I believe this was happening, or he said this when R2-D2 and the other astromechs were going to the hull of the Queen's ship to repair the shield generator, because the scene is introducing R2-D2, but it's also elevating the stakes of what our heroes are facing and advancing the plot along that way and adding to the action. We're going to come back to this in just a little bit because George does contradict himself some, which that's just kind of always fun to point out. Oh, you're right, Buster. George did have a lot to say about just the new visuals and environments that we got in The Phantom Menace, because this was, again, the first thing we'd gotten since the prequels. And he mentioned environments as an element of storytelling. Again, paraphrasing, George called new environments are important using to tell the story without being too bizarre. So this was in reference to the first time we saw a royal city like the city of Theed or the underwater Gungan village of Otogunga. They are, quote, believable within the confines of Star Wars, but different enough from what we've seen that they still serve the purpose of introducing new aspects, but they're not so far out there that they break the established reality of Star Wars. If you recall, the first third to half of The Phantom Menace features frequent cuts back to Newt Gunray, whatever his second-in-command's name is, and the Nemoidians that are in charge of the Trade Federation. And George made special note in the edit that every time we cut back to the Trade Federation, he was saying this when we first see the hologram of Darth Maul, that there is a new element of danger added every time we cut back to them. Whether that's an increase in the number of droids they have, or we see the landers and troop tanks, or in this case, seeing Darth Maul as the new element of danger, it's always escalating the enemy's position every time we cut back to them. No, I didn't forget seeing that George contradicted himself, and he didn't necessarily go directly against what he said about a scene should do more than one thing. It should not only serve one purpose. When our heroes are gathered around Anakin and Shmi's dinner table, the scene where Qui-Gon like grabs Jar Jar's tongue when he tries to grab the space apple. This was a 6 to 8 minute shot that George spent actually a lot of time talking about how it's difficult to film a shot like this just with the multiple camera angles and with, you know, an 8 or 9 year old actor having to know a lot of lines and understand a lot of context of what's going on. But George described this as nothing but an exposition scene, which does sort of contradict what he said earlier. But he justifies it by saying this is an unfortunate scene that you have to have in almost every movie, and it usually happens within the first third of the movie, the first 30 to 40 minutes. He's right. This is kind of the only continuous or the longest continuous exposition scene that we get in The Phantom Menace. See here, what's next? Oh, yeah. Jumping back to the nightfall scene on the balcony where Qui-Gon tests the blood of Anakin Skywalker, talking about midichlorians, George justifies midichlorians here, saying that this is something he'd had in his vision from the beginning, but never had the time or space to talk about in the original trilogy. The symbiosis of the microscopic level working with the Force, and then the microscopic level working with you to harness the Force. I don't necessarily believe that George specifically thought of the midichlorians back in the original trilogy, but I do believe that in the time between completing Return of the Jedi and starting Phantom Menace, he did kind of think of the concept and flesh it out so that he could use it to retroactively justify the Force or events that happened in the original trilogy. You're right. Speaking of elements that were back in the original trilogy that kind of carry through the prequels and the original trilogy, during the Senate meeting scene when Padme calls for the vote of no confidence in Chancellor Valorum, George talks about the thematic issue of Palpatine's quest for power transcending all six movies. In this film, his goal is to elevate himself from senator to chancellor. Episode 2, to elevate the position of Chancellor to being a more powerful military position. And then obviously Episode 3, expand those emergency powers to being a full-time emperor. That might fall apart when you put under scrutiny with the sequel trilogy in Episode 9, but that's something I'm definitely going to keep in mind as I continue this series. Here's another tidbit for aspiring screenwriters, just talking about the difficulties of writing a script with such a large cast. This was mentioned when Qui-Gon said that Obi-Wan is ready to become a Jedi Knight so that I can take Anakin with me, trying to keep the party together, so to speak. George just said that one of the problems writing a script with lots of characters is you need good reasons for everyone to go along on the journey. Keeping that in mind as we continue watching all of these films, it'll be interesting to see if we come across any maybe weaker reasons of did they really need to be there, or just if everything is actually fairly well established of we do need all of our principal heroes going on this mission. Buster, were you surprised at the reveal that the handmaiden Padme was actually Queen Amidala? Well, You weren't alone in that. You know who was not surprised, though, was Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi. George did confirm in the scene where she reveals her true identity that Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan knew all along that Padme was queen, and they had been waiting on her to step up and take charge of the situation. I can definitely see that with Qui-Gon trying to, you know, push her to do the right thing, especially in some of their interactions back on Tatooine. I was more surprised that George said that Obi-Wan was aware of it. Maybe the Jedi just saw through the lie, or the fact that, oh, Keira Knightley and Natalie Portman don't actually look super alike. And as George is wont to do, he ties this back into his experiences in college. He talks about Vietnam, which, again, a lot of Return of the Jedi is based on the Vietnam War. He brings up the Vietnam War and how one side had all the technology, the other side didn't. Again, paraphrasing here, but I like technology, I use technology, but I understand its failings and I know that it can't do everything, which is probably a good lesson in, you know, filmmaking and life beyond that. There are two sides to that dilemma. He goes on to say that there's no replacement for a human spirit, particularly like that we see in the good droids. So like we see in R2, C-3PO, the battle droids that are devoid of that, quote, human spirit are much less effective than the droids that have personality. Yeah, exactly. Like you are much more effective to this story, and you're much more personable than a Roger would have been. You're a much better co-host. Thanks, Buster. Let's see, I've got two more notes from George here. And looking back, yes, everything in this storytelling section was from George Lucas, so that's very fitting. George talks about Anakin and Jar Jar playing parallel roles, which I had never considered before. They're both somewhat bumbling through the action. Jar Jar on the battlefield as a, quote, commander who lucks his way through, has some comedic moments, but manages to end up being an effective combatant and leader. And Anakin doing the same thing, originally stuck on autopilot, but delivering the final shot to the core of the droid control ship. It seems obvious when you state it that way, but I had never considered that Anakin and Jar Jar actually did have parallel journeys. They were both bumbling about, but they ended up emerging as heroes. And the last thing from George that I want to talk about happens during the Gungan marching band sequence. It's just another part of themes or consistency across movies for him. He just talked about the musical sequence at the end has no dialogue. Lasts about 2 minutes, and it goes to almost the end credits, and so it starts the same and ends the same. So thinking about its parallels to A New Hope, we've got, you know, the medal ceremony doesn't have any dialogue. It's mainly driven by music and the cuts of the main characters. That's what we get here of Boss Nass and Jar Jar approaching with the Gungan marching band. I guess we do have some dialogue when he says, "We have peace," and holds up the shiny disco ball. But it's largely just driven by the emotion of the music, which is pretty cool. No, I promise this last section won't take as long to get through. So this is just some random things that I found interesting on my watch through of the director commentary. George Lucas says things funny, and these were not one-offs. I like went back and double-checked. I like rewound when I was watching the Blu-ray. I guess I should say I am watching the commentary that is on the 2006, I believe, complete Blu-ray box set. Maybe it's a couple years later from that, but it's the one that's episode 1 through 6. It's got the 3 bonus discs, but this is the commentary track that's just embedded on the Phantom Menace disc. But George calls holograms holograms, this hologram of Darth Maul. So that sounded funny to me. And he also calls the planet Naboo. So back when they returned to Naboo, that was too much of my accent coming through there, but he definitely calls it Naboo, which is kind of funny. Yeah, I know I can't get rid of that just slight Oklahoma accent. Sorry about that. I thought about maybe including this in storytelling, but I think it's maybe just more of a random tidbit that's interesting conversation. When we meet Anakin and Sebulba, they are established rivals. Even though Anakin has never finished a race, maybe that's because Sebulba has always prevented that, but George explicitly said that we never got to learn the backstory of Anakin and Sebulba and how they became rivals. That could be an interesting one-off, like, comic or Star Wars Kids YouTube channel short of Anakin establishing himself as a pod racer as a threat to Sebulba. Could be fun. I did not include a lot of it here. You would need to just actually go watch the commentary track, but it is fascinating how they brought the puppet of metal skinless C-3PO to life. But George did talk about, no, I intentionally wanted Anakin or Darth Vader to be C-3PO's father, just like he's the father to Luke and Leia. I think it's ironic. And that's not a good George Lucas, but that's what he said. We're almost done. I've just got one last thing that was mind-blowing to me that I had never noticed it before. I've seen this movie dozens of times, but this was from John Knoll, one of the visual effects supervisors, during the pod racing scene. He just flat out admits, yeah, we made a mistake in the version that got shipped. So towards the end of the pod race, when Anakin and Sebulba start to get entangled, we cut back and forth between shots like above the two pod racers showing them entangled and then a view of looking at Anakin and seeing Sebulba's cockpit behind him. I think it's on the third cutback when we are looking at Anakin. You can see Sebulba's pod racer over Anakin's left shoulder, I think, but they forgot to reinsert Sebulba into the pod racing cockpit. So this whole time we've seen Sebulba like driving and everything, but on this cutback, Sebulba is missing. You just see the like chair of his cockpit. It only lasts about 2 or 3 seconds, if that, but it is just a mistake that made it into the final cut of the movie. I need to go watch this on Disney Plus and see if it made it to that version. And we know that George shows early cuts of his films to his friends, and he's got some awesome friends like Steven Spielberg and Ron Howard. And Ron Howard offered a suggestion on the pod racing scene that I think was great. Once Anakin's pod has had that one cable detached, it was originally a much shorter scene, but Ron suggested drag this out, show him trying different ways to repair it, use it to build the tension so that when we get the final payoff of Sebulba exploding, that we get a better like release from it. And I think Ron Howard was right. Maybe they should let that guy direct a Star Wars movie. Yeah, you're right. It's time to wrap it up. So that is gonna do it for this first installment of Comments on Commentary. Thank you for sticking through with me. As I just kind of talked about my journey through the director's commentary. I had a good time watching this and taking notes. Not all the notes I took made it to the podcast episode, but I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Look for my comments on commentary on episode 2, Attack of the Clones, in the next couple weeks. I'm dreading that one a little bit. Attack of the Clones, my least favorite of all of the movies, but I hope that I can still learn some positives from it. Just be on the lookout for regular episodes of our main The Canon Cantina show, along with some of these new projects we're working on, like hashtag This Is SW Madness, our March Madness bracket style tournament of 64 characters. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at The Canon Cantina. You can send us an email to canoncantina@gmail.com. Look us up on iTunes, give us a rating or review. We appreciate all of you that have stuck with us through the first year and a half or so of the show, and those of you that have come back after our brief hiatus and the soft reboot that we've done of the show. And I'm particularly grateful that you're listening when I'm doing this solo with B5. But that will do it for this first installment of our limited series Comments on Commentary here in the Canon Cantina. Cheers, everybody, and may the Force be with you.
Conversation anyway.